So we can start this morning's Dharma talk. And as I promised last night, when somebody asked me, can you please talk about the Satipatthana? It's a big subject, so it doesn't really allow itself to be just treated lightly in a question time, in 2 or 3 minutes. So I thought I'd talk about it and a few other things in this morning's talk. Obviously, I'm trying not to get too technical, simply because, as you all know, that people come on this retreat, some for the first time, some they may not even be Buddhists, but they want to learn how to meditate. And so I have to be very careful to make the talk easily understandable and appropriate for everybody, no matter what stage of their meditation path they're actually on. So I'm going to try to make this talk easy understandable so everyone can gain something from it. But if you go to meditation retreats, you'll always hear that term, the Satipatthana, and a little bit about the history of it, that long time ago it was just the Eightfold Path is what Buddhists did. That's the way of meditation, just Eightfold Path, Eightfold Path, Eightfold Path. And I already mentioned to you that in the suttas, the word of the Buddha, it's mentioned so often that that is the way to become enlightened, the Eightfold Path. Right from the very beginning, always say that the Eightfold Path is the way, the only way to become enlightened. However, people always like to take shortcuts. And so if there's any possibility of doing away with any of those eight factors, we try and get a sevenfold path, or a sixfold, or a fivefold, or four, because human beings love shortcuts. But my experience is whenever you take a shortcut, you always tend to get lost and take more time to get to your destination, because the ordinary route, the route which is used by most people, is used by most people for a reason. It is the best way to get there. And my story of this, because there's many Sri Lankans here who can understand this story, I was once invited into Sri Lanka and I gave a talk in Kandy at the university. And after giving the talk at the university, there were several cars came with me from Colombo, and they all started driving me back. But one, my particular driver, he decided to take a shortcut. Why my driver? Because everybody got back into Colombo about 4 hours before we did. That's a long delay. Because he got totally lost. And for those of you, you know, who were Sinhalese, you'll understand this. Because now on the road from Kandy to Colombo, we took a shortcut. We ended up just a little bit, a few kilometers north of Kalutara. That is a long way round. Now, Sri Lanka's noticed. I mean, that really is getting lost. And it's only a small island. It's not that big. You should be able to know that. You lived in there all your life. But that has often happened to me. So these days when someone says, I know a shortcut, I say, well, you can go there, but please take me the ordinary way. But the thing is, we always like shortcuts. And sometimes that people try and make those shortcuts, even in meditation, even in Buddhism. Somebody comes along with a new way of meditation, a new path. They've discovered something which has been hidden for many years. Only when people are intelligent enough to be able to see this. Now, the intelligent people have suddenly arose. There's no intelligent people in the time of the Buddha. Only now. And then they have these, and it's very, very good marketing because people like shortcuts. But there is only that one way, the Eightfold Path. And just in brief, and there has to be sort of a right view, first of all, a basic understanding, you know, of the nature of existence, even if it's only theory, because you've read it, you have trust in your teachers, especially trust in the Buddha, that he knew what he was talking about. Now that should give you a lot of confidence that, you know, what he said must make sense, even if you don't understand it. Now, there must be something there. There's no selfishness. Keep on talking about this everywhere in the suttas. So there must be something there. So even if you don't understand it, you just keep it in mind as a type of right view. You know, no craving. Learning how to let things be. As I mentioned in the first evening, and I'm going to repeat here because part of this talk is also carrying on from yesterday's talk about the problems in meditation. Get to the heart of it. If you've got frustrated so far, if you have got sort of really sort of no real peace in the meditation, why? Remember what I said, the two types of meditation? Second Noble Truth Meditation and Third Noble Truth Meditation. Second Noble Truth, wanting, craving, desire is a cause of suffering. So if you've had difficult meditation, you've been suffering, frustrated, it must mean you've been wanting something, craving something, desiring something. Buddha said that's a cause of suffering. So if you're suffering, that's a cause of it. You've wanted something, you crave for it, that is why the meditation doesn't work. And the third Noble Truth, letting go, I mentioned the four ways of letting go. Letting go of craving, of wanting, is the path to Nibbana. So every time you have a peaceful, beautiful meditation, can you not notice it was because you didn't want anything? You'd actually let go. You were content. You just let it happen. You didn't drive your vehicle. You really were a passenger. You just let go. And then things started to work. They should be reminding you, teaching you the two types of meditation. So what that also means, if you've been suffering, having a difficult time, it's nothing to do with you. It's not that you can't meditate. There's some genetic fault in you. Other people can get enlightened, but not you, because the DNA is not correct. Or you weren't born in the right country, or you haven't got the right gender, or you haven't done this or done that. That is gomayang. The only reason why a person doesn't get good meditation is because they want something, they're craving. I told this little story, it's just to show sometimes how stupid I am, during one of the interviews. Two or three years ago now, this gentleman appeared on one of my retreats here in Jhana Grove. And when he was like checking in, I took one look at him and thought he got the wrong place. Because this was a big Australian man with tattoos all over him. And quite frankly, he looked more like a member of a bikie gang, like a Hell's Angel or Coffin Cheetah, those big bikie gangs, than anyone who had ever come to a meditation retreat. And my mistake was, I make mistakes too, I judged him. I said, sir, you've got the wrong place. The prison is up the road. He said, no, I'm on your retreat. Oh, really? Okay. we can all be stupid. So, there he was. And so he was on this retreat, and he was the one who really blew my mind, because he came for one of the interviews, and he said, had a really nice experience. You could see something was happening, he was really happy. And he told me exactly what he was doing and what had occurred. And I, you know me, that I don't say you have deep meditation unless I'm really convinced. And I told him, I said, well, that was a jhana. You did it, you go into a jhana. And that blew my mind, because he was the last person I would ever expect to get a jhana. And he did it. And that just taught me lessons. You don't know who's going to get this jhana. Just because you've been coming to the Buddhist society for so many years. And these Jojos, they rock up. I don't know where they've come from. All tattoos all over him. And then he just gets a jhana straight away. Wow, amazing, isn't it? And now the lesson is get some tattoos. No lesson at all. The lesson is it doesn't really matter that, you know, he was actually doing letting go meditation. He got it. He understood straight away. So that is always to be kept in mind. Any problem in your meditation is because you're wanting something. You're controlling again. That is the reason why the mind doesn't become still. Okay, I'm going to do this. I'll do this every retreat. I haven't really done it yet. I won't do it the normal way when I play around and get someone to actually check on me. I'm now going to hold this water perfectly still. And it's not still. It's moving. You know why it's moving? I'm not paying attention, am I? I'm not being mindful. Now I'm mindful. I'm paying attention. It's moving. The reason is because I'm not concentrating. Now I'll be mindful and I'll concentrate. It always works, you know. When I concentrate, it moves more. Honest, I'm being absolutely honest with you. The more I concentrate, the less still it becomes. Now this is how many people meditate. The reason I say this is because you try and hold your mind still and you just get frustrated. It never works. And you've all seen me do this demonstration before. It's so easy to get this piece of water to be totally still. Bung it down. And as soon as I put it down, and it moves more, it's really moving a lot now, much more than when I was holding it. So when you do let go, you can expect the mind to become a bit more restless, a bit more dull. You're not holding it, you're not controlling it. But be patient. It's still moving a little bit. Now that's still. That water is incredibly still. There's no way in the world I could ever hold a cup of water and get it that still. Now that is a teaching which I hope you understand. That water represents your mind. And the only reason why your mind doesn't get still is because you're holding it, trying to make it still. You let it go, put it down, and it becomes still. Now our problem is, second noble truth meditation, third noble truth meditation, or just putting things down, letting them go. Sometimes, actually most times, we're not really mindful enough to know what we're doing. So a lot of times you're meditating there and you're doing something and you can't see it. Because the mindfulness is not established and it's not strong yet. An example of this. You know, I was always taught and I always believed that when you are meditating, stray thoughts just come into your mind. I didn't know where they came from, they just came into my mind. My mind was pretty peaceful, so they would leave pretty easily too. My story of opening the door of your heart, you must always remember, a door is not just to come in, it's also to go out. So when you open the door of your heart, it's also for things to go out as well. Not to keep on getting things coming in. But these thoughts would come in and then they would go out and another one would come in and then they would go out. And until I really created a lot of mindfulness and was really aware, I always thought it was not my doing. But when you got really mindful, really aware, I saw what was truly going on. I was actually going out looking for a thought and bringing it back in. They weren't coming in by themselves. I was going out catching them and bringing them back in. And that is what happens to you. Thoughts don't come from nowhere. You actually go seeking them. But for most of you, your mindfulness is not strong enough to see that yet. All the disturbances of the mind, you all make them happen. You're doing something. And a lot of times you're deliberately trying to disturb yourself, really sabotaging your meditation because you're a bit scared, afraid of the peace and the profundity. What are you going to see when your mind becomes still? Many people aren't ready for that. Fair enough. But at least you know what's happening. You sabotage stuff. No, a bit too much for me. So you're afraid of peace. You know, one of the first times I noticed how many people are afraid of peace was when they would come into Bodhinyana Monastery the first year. There's not much there. There's not many monks there, not many people there. And when visitors would come into the forest, they'd raise their voice. Instead of speaking at a normal level, they would actually almost be shouting. And I couldn't figure that out at first. Why do people have to make so much noise in a quiet place? And it was because the peace threatened them. They weren't used to it. And they had to make it noisy so they could feel more at home with what they were used to. And that is the same as us as well. And because of that, the mindfulness started to understand a basic psychology of going to places where you've never been before. And it's my teaching of recognition, familiarity and ease. It's another part of this letting go process. And to understand what I mean, when you first came to this retreat center, many of you come in here for the first time, you don't know where your room is, you don't know what is the rainwater tap, what is a hot water tap, you don't know where the toilets are, there's so much you don't know, and the people you're sharing your cottage with, you don't really know who they are, and many of you didn't know who I was. It's amazing that some people say, oh, I'm really afraid. Is that your mom? Ah! From my understanding of myself, other people tell me, I'm one of the softest monks in the whole universe. I don't carry a Zen stick and I never shout at anybody. It's amazing, unless you're deaf. But I never scold you. But people are still on edge when they see something or stay someplace where they're not used to. And you may have noticed that here, the first night in your bed, you never sleep that well. And that happens often, because I go traveling, I sleep in all sorts of beds, you know, and hotels and other places around the world. And the first night you never get a good night's sleep because, you know, you don't know the bed, you don't know the pillow. But now you've been in this place for how many days, 3, 4, 5 days now. Now you know your pillow and your pillow knows you. You're familiar. So from recognition we get to this familiarity. Oh, I know this place. I know the people in my cottage. So you relax. Your guards go down, you're not so protective, you feel more safe and comfortable, you know where everything is. It does become a second home to you. And some people come here so often, it is like a second home to you. And therefore you get to the last stage, you're at ease. All of your defense mechanisms stop and you just let the place be. Those are the three stages. Recognition, familiarity and ease. And that also happens with stages of meditation. You know, when you first say, it's amazing, just little things like watch the breath. And now I've got to stop myself because I've been watching the breath for a long time. I know what that is. But you know, a lot of people, when they first meditate, they haven't got a clue what I'm talking about. What do you mean the breath? What is the breath? What am I supposed to watch? But after a while, you recognize, you know, what this thing is called the breathing. Not the tip of the nose, it's the feeling of the breath. Once you recognize it, and then become familiar, oh, it's only the old breath. And then you can relax with it, which means you don't try and control it and becomes nice and soft and easy. Just like you don't need to get tense when you go to bed or when you meet people here. You know everybody by sight anyway. So you relax. So even with parts of the meditation, same. Recognize, familiarity and ease. And that's really important when you get peaceful. The other day when I was talking about the insight of saying the word peace, 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 again and again with pauses in, that was yesterday, because I wanted you to recognize, now what do we mean by peace? What do we mean by kindness? To recognize, not the word, but what it points to. And once you recognize what peace is, what silence is, you'll disturb it until you become familiar with it. And when you're familiar with it, then you can let it be. You're at ease with it. You tend not to disturb the silence. You know, psychology, oh, it's just silence, I know that. So you don't have to do anything. It's safe, you've been there before, it's not challenging to you. you can just let go and allow the silence to be. Because you've gone through the three stages, recognition, familiarity, and ease. And that is even more important when you get to the deeper stages of meditation, like nimittas. Still people say, what are nimittas? I saw a light without a nimitta, and quite frankly, I just get a little bit bored when people say, oh, I saw a light, was it a nimitta? Look, it was a nimitta. Every time people come and ask me those questions, you know, in the interviews, in the old days, I would actually ask you all these other questions. What was happening? Where were you? What was going on? And these days, oh, come on. 99.9% of the time, if you see a light in your mind, it is the nimitta. But it's what really amazes me, why people always doubt it. Because you're doubting yourself. You're doubting your abilities. You're thinking, wow, this nimitta is high states of mind, not me. Maybe monks or nuns or people have been coming here for years, but me? That self-doubt is what sabotages stuff. I can't do this, not me, somebody else. It's a lack of the ability, the lack of recognizing that everybody can actually walk this path and become enlightened. It's a very beautiful teaching of the Buddha. Every human being can. So there's no barriers. Race, gender, age, even sickness. So, that means that don't doubt. But after a while, when the nimitta first comes up, again, sometimes we can sort of recognize it. But we're not familiar, which is why we control it. Why people, when nimittas first come up, they flash and they're gone. And they maybe come up again, you can't sustain it. Why? Because you're doing something. What you're doing is because, you know, you're not at ease with it. Just like, you know, you tense up when you're first night in your bed. You can't sleep so well. Just a little bit of fear of the unknown. So with even nimittas, get them coming up. Flash, that's okay. Flash, 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 until you get used to them. You recognize them. You become familiar with them. Oh, it's only just a nimitta again. Oh, okay, just an old nimitta. Just a beautiful, brilliant night. More bliss than sex. Oh, it's just that one again. You get so familiar, you're at ease with it, which means you don't disturb it, you just let it be. So those are important stages to understand. And it's because you haven't gone through those three stages of recognition, familiarity and ease, that is why we keep doing stuff. But we're not mindful enough to see it until, you know, later on in our meditation practice, we get so aware, we can see all the stuff which the mind does. And the way to overcome the problems is just to know them. That is all. Sometimes people think, oh, we have to get rid of these problems. We have to stop them. We have to suppress them. We have to do something. Beat them up. Kick them in the guts, as John Wayne used to say. But we are not John Wayne. We are not U.S. Marines. Instead, all we do is know them. And this is one of the great similes which you read again and again and again throughout the suttas. The simile of the problems being like manifestations of Mara. Mara. You know, it's not a devil like in Buddhism. That devil is just a really weird concept in Christianity. Because apparently that God created everything, must have created the devil as well. That's a stupid thing to do. Create the devil. Who would want to do that? That's a mean thing to do. But anyway, this is nothing to do with Christianity. Mara is the person who always tries to disturb you, to irritate you, to do anything to stop you getting peaceful, getting enlightened. And that's like Mara. And it can be a personification of all these wantings and fears and troubles which come up in your meditation. And traditionally, when Mara would come and try and disturb a good meditator, all the meditator would say, aha, I know you, Mara. And Mara would reply, oh, the monk, the nun, the layman, the laywoman, she knows me. And then Mama would always retreat with his shoulders hunched, his head drooping. Oh, they know me. Always overcome through wisdom, never through force. You can't beat Mara up. Or you can say, I know you. And then Mara leaves you straight away. And that is very, very accurate to what happens any place in your meditation. When your mindfulness gets strong enough and you see the problem, it vanishes. I was wanting something. I was trying. I was doing something. I was expecting something. Which is one of the biggest problems in meditation. Always expecting. I know there is one lady over there who's expecting. She's allowed to be expected. She's pregnant. But you're allowed to expect, okay. It's your body. But everybody else, no one else here is pregnant, I hope. But, especially the guys. So you've got no reason to expect, okay. So, instead of expecting something to happen, we look outside ourselves. That's expecting, looking outside. And even that word, instead of expecting, we inspect. That's mindfulness. Expecting is looking for somewhere else. Looking in the future, looking into the past, looking outside of where you are right now. So, inspect, that's mindfulness. Expecting is a big problem. So you're sitting there, and already people come and complain to me. Look, you told me to let go, I've been letting go, letting go, letting go, but nothing's happened. Of course, that's what letting go is. Nothing happens. You're expecting, you're wanting something, you're not really letting go. I've been letting go for 4 days now, nothing's happened. You haven't been letting go. It's another business deal. I will let go if I get something. Which is wrong. You see that after a while. I know you, Mara. I've seen that. So then when you understand what's going on, you don't do that anymore. And then, all the things we're expecting and never came, when you stop expecting them, then they come. One last little simile before I get on to Satipatthana was last night mentioned Angulimala. Stop. And there is a simile which I was thinking of telling last night, but not really enough time, of how it works. What's stopping got to do with letting go? And many of you know this simile is one of my favorites, an original Ajahn Brahma, I never got this from Ajahn Chah, of the donkey and the carrot. It's a wonderful simile. Donkey, stubborn little animal, you can beat it with a stick, doesn't move. Just like husbands. So you don't beat husbands with a stick, they'll get the stick and beat you back again. Or, you know, like the Zen master, if you beat somebody, they'll call the police and have you arrested. So you don't use a stick like that. You tie the stick to the donkey's neck, so the front of the stick is 2 foot in front of the donkey's head. On the end of the stick, you tie a string. On the end of the string, you tie a carrot, so the donkey just sees a carrot 2 foot in front of it. That's not that far. And so the donkey moves to catch the carrots. And of course, when the donkey moves, the stick moves, the string moves, and the carrot moves. So you don't need to get any more than one carrot. You put it in front on the end of the string, and the donkey moves as far as you want. And the donkey moves because it always thinks it's going to catch the carrot, but never does. Just like your meditation. You can see, oh, this makes a lot of sense. You move towards it, and whatever you're trying to find moves away from you. Or just like life. You almost get happiness. You almost get contentment. You almost get your goal in life. And you go towards it, and it moves away from you. Just like the carrot on the end of the string. And people know that story. You know, the donkey, the stick, and the carrot. But you don't know how donkeys catch the carrot. It's just so easy. It's so easy to reach your goals, to get nimittas, jhanas, once you understand. You're chasing these things. The more you chase them, the further they go. So donkey has been chasing the carrot for quite a long time now, running as fast as it can after the carrot. And then the donkey hears about the Buddha's teaching to Angulimala. Stop. So the donkey stops. What happens to the carrot? It goes further away. In a momentum. Just like when I put the cup down. It moves more when you let go. When you stop, the carrot goes further away. But the carrot goes so far away, 4 foot in front of the donkey's mouth, the donkey has faith, confidence, doesn't move. That's what happens with a lot of people, you know. They start letting go, and, you know, it doesn't really, really work, so they don't give it enough patience, and they start doing something. So 4 feet away, my meditation's going terrible, they say. No, before my meditation was, not good, but it's much better than this. Now I'm sleeping a lot, my mind is going all over the place. I better stop and change and start concentrating. That's just like the carrot 4 foot in, 4 foot in front of the mouth, and the donkey starts saying, "Oh, it's going wrong, it's not working," and starts running after it again. But no, the donkey stops, has faith. Because then something strange happens. The carrot starts coming towards the donkey. And that's the weirdest thing in meditation. You totally give up, you let go, you don't do anything, you're just sitting here. And all these stages, they just come to you. You don't do anything. You just stand here, sit here, eyes closed, and you start till the breath comes. Wow, so easy. You can watch the breath for hours. You don't do anything, it just comes to you. Breath becomes really beautiful. See the whole lot? I never did that. So the carrot starts coming towards the donkey. And soon that carrot is in its usual place, 2 foot in front of the donkey's mouth. But now the carrot is coming really fast towards the donkey's mouth. And it swings and swings and swings so close to the donkey's mouth. Nimittas come, jhanas one after the other. Wow, amazing. And at the very end, as I often say, it's not just stopping and being still. Never ever forget compassion and kindness. At the very end, the donkey has to remember, carrot, the door of my mouth is open to you. Otherwise, the carrot hits the donkey's teeth and bounces out again. So close, but you never actually get the enlightenment. That's most simply of how donkeys catch carrots. It's so easy once you understand it. Why didn't you think of that before? That's how you meditate as well. Stop chasing after stuff. Stop. And all this stuff comes to you. But you've got to be patient. So after a while, you have to be mindful enough to know what stopping is. Just stop. Stop in the present moment. Stop worrying about this afternoon, tomorrow, yesterday, or whatever. And amazing what happens. So what's that got to do with Satipatthana? Mindfulness. That's what Satipatthana is. And in this particular stage of Satipatthana, the seventh factor of the Eightfold Path, this is not about getting enlightened, it's about getting enough strong mindfulness that you can do Samadhi, the next factor of the Eightfold Path. It becomes the foundation of the stillness, to get enough mindfulness so you can see all the problems which stop you being still. Purpose, to create incredible deep stillness. And the mindfulness there is to find out why not. So they say there's a four, they sometimes are foundations of mindfulness, but I like to call them the four focuses of mindfulness. Where you put your mindfulness on in order to create strong awareness, enough to be able to get the jhanas. So, first of all, just to do a bit of housekeeping and just clear away some rubbish on the four Satipatthanas, where some, and I call them scallywag teachers, and they deserve the term, that they teach this is the only way to enlightenment. It does not mean that at all. The Pali word is called ekayana, not ekayana. Yana is a vehicle. Eka does mean one. And it's just the basic error in Pali, which any person who just started learning Pali can see that one. It's a different word. It's ekayana. Ayana means a going, a single going. And that same word is used in the very next sutta, the Mahakamma Vibhanga Sutta, after the Satipatthana. Satipatthana Sutta is in the Majjhima Nikaya, it's number 10. Look at number 11. It's the only other place in the whole Tripitaka where they use the word ekayana. And there it's in a simile, where the Buddha is answering, how come you know if a person, you know, say, breaks the five precepts, they're going to go to a lower realm? How can you be sure of that? He said, it's just like in the forest, you see there's a path, and the path hasn't got a left turn, a right turn, and no U-turns are allowed. And you know at the end of the path is a big pit of hot coals. You know, anyone walking that path, you can't go left, you can't go right, you can't U-turn, you're going to end up in that pit of coals. And he called that is an ekayana path, which only has one destination, it's going to go there, and there's no other possibilities. It doesn't mean the only way, but it means a way with only one destination. So if you keep practicing the Eightfold Path, or practicing Satipatthana, keep on at it, eventually it's going to lead there. But it's not the only pathway, because you need the Eightfold Path, other stuff as well. So that's the first thing. And the second thing about the Satipatthana, they have another phrase in it. This is for those who have, you know, been Buddhists a long time, and you've heard this. For those of you just coming just to get a bit of peace and quiet, you can just zone out if you wish, because this is technical stuff. They got a phrase with each of the Satipatthana, Vinaya Loke Abhijja Dhammanasang, which is usually translated as having abandoned grief and covetousness for the world. And when I became a young Buddhist, I thought, what the heck does that mean? And when I became a much more knowledgeable Buddhist and started learning Pali and reading the suttas for myself, it was obvious what that phrase means. And it's, Loke Abhijja is a synonym for the first of the five hindrances, usually Kamachanda, but many times, 30 or 40 times, the five hindrances begin with Loke Abhijja. It's a synonym, a word which has the same meaning as the Kamachanda. And Dhammanasa is used in two places in the suttas as a synonym for the second hindrances, usually called Vyapada. So they're synonyms for the five hindrances. And all the commentaries, the Satipatthana suttas, there's two main ones, one in the Digha, one in the Majjhima. All the commentaries, this is how it's explained. It means having not abandoned the five hindrances, not abandoned, having restrained the five hindrances, lessened them, which is what the previous factors are supposed to do. So in other words, you're already calm. You've had enough practice to develop this minimum level of mindfulness by abandoning the hindrances. And what the Kamachanda is, that's wanting. Vyapada is ill will, not wanting. So you spent enough time restraining those two that you do have enough mindfulness to actually do Satipatthana. The preparation is necessary. And I think already on this retreat you have some idea what mindfulness is, but also the power of mindfulness, its strength. And if mindfulness is weak, you just can't see anything, you can't hear anything, so you're not aware enough. So, the first thing, you know, this is in the Satipatthana Sutta, get your mindfulness strong first of all. Get it going, because in ordinary life, you're not really very mindful at all. And it's not your fault, you have to do too much, you're tired, your brain is just so exhausted. It hasn't got enough energy to really be aware of what's going on. You're just getting by, that's all. But when you come on a retreat like this, the reason why I get you to rest and relax and have a bit of fun, the reason why I tell jokes, is to increase your mindfulness with happiness, with a bit of joy, with relaxation, being peaceful. That starts to get the mindfulness strong. And you will notice that when the food starts to taste more delicious. You'll start to notice that when the flowers become more beautiful. You get to notice that when you can feel your body more. Your mindfulness is increasing because you're not so distracted and tired out by all the other things you have to do in life. It's a simple place, this retreat center. You don't have to do much, even though you do much more than you ask for in your head. Still, your mindfulness starts to increase. And when it gets to a certain level, then that's when we say, okay, now you can practice Satipatthana. You can be sort of mindful. And the four things you're mindful of are your body, experience. This is what they call Vedana. Some people say it's, you know, the pleasure, the pain, in between. But what it really means is experience. What's it like to experience stuff? And the mind, which is the hardest one. And they have this thing called the mind objects. But in particular, as many of my friends, including Ajahn Bhamani, but especially people like Ajahn Analio and people like Ajahn Sujata, it's great that there's now senior Western monks who are knowledgeable and smart. Now, Ajahn Bhamani, he's got two MAs. He's what I call a mama. So I call him Mama Bhamani. So he's a big black mama. No, he's a big white mama. Mama Bhamani. He is, M-A-M-A, mama. If a PhD is, what did I call it again, permanent head damage, two MAs is mama. So anyway, Mama Bhamani and other people with similar sort of qualifications. Now look at the Satipatthana, and there's many different versions of it. And you see, the most simple version is more likely to be the oldest. We always like to add things on. Very rarely take things away. And the earliest part of the Satipatthana, the earliest version, in the fourth Satipatthana, you know, of the focuses of mindfulness on the Dhamma, there's only two sections. And that is on the five hindrances and the seven enlightenment factors. And they're actually opposite. You know, the seven enlightenment factors are what happens when you overcome and abandon the five hindrances. The five hindrances are what stops the enlightenment factors developing. So that's actually what you're actually doing. Mindful enough, are the hindrances there? Are you really sleepy? Are you restless? Have you got no doubt? Which is one of the other big things which people have in life. You know, it's amazing. Like doubts say about the nimitta. What's this nimitta? What's this not? And give yourself the benefit of the doubt. Yeah, it is, okay? Can I do this? Can I not do this? Maybe I haven't, you know, got the abilities. Maybe some bad karma I did in the past life, I can't become enlightened. Give yourself the benefit of the doubt. Don't just doubt. Which is usually when people doubt, it means a lot of negativity. I'm hopeless. I can't do this. I come up here in the morning and see all these people sitting up straight and I just want to go to bed. Oh, these people really make me sick. All the people in the room, they're just probably enlightened by now, not me. It really sucks. You really compare yourself to others and you get very upset. No, it's not like that at all. So don't doubt, especially with negativity. And not even about the path. Is this the right type of meditation? Is there a better type of meditation? Should I do this type? Should I do that type? Is Ajahn Brahm the best teacher or should I go and do some other teachers? These days you can actually get books which rate us. I was very, very pleased that somebody read a book on meditation, especially on the jhanas. And they rated about five teachers and I was one of them. Now, who is easiest to get jhana under? But, you know, who has like the lowest like threshold to get jhanas? And that was actually Ayakema. Ayakema says, she said you got jhanas, it's like, you know, quite low. You know, what she requires you to experience to get a jhana. And number two, Paroxidor. It's very tough under Paroxidor to be confirmed, yes, you've got a jhana. But the toughest of all was me. They say, oh, if Ajahn Brahm says you've got a jhana, that's really hard to get that. Because he is the toughest, You know, he will only say you've got a jhana if you've really, really got all these things, you know, fully, strongly in line. I was really pleased about that. I got number one rating. Okay, you say, Ajahn Brahm, you're proud. It's not proud. I'm humble. I often tell people I'm the most humble monk in the whole world. And I want to apply to Guinness Book of Records for the most humble monk award. Because you know, what's the point of being humble if you don't let people know about it? I'm only messing about. So sometimes, you know, the two Satipatthana, the last of the Satipatthanas, the fourth of like the objects, it's either, have you got a hindrance there? Really? Be mindful enough to know. Or is it the opposite, the enlightenment factors? So actually you get to know these things. But in particular, the beginning of the four Satipatthanas is on the body. And sometimes we say, well, haven't we done Satipatthana meditation? Can't we try it now? You have done it. You know, right at the very beginning, when I asked you to, you know, be aware of the way you're sitting, and actually have a look at, you know, once you're comfortable, have a look at the part of the body which is a bit tense, which needs some effort to actually, or not effort, but needs some tender loving care to relax it, to make it nice and easy. That is the first Satipatthana I was teaching there. Mindfulness of your body. So, but also, because it is getting rid of physical suffering, getting rid of pain, it actually gives you a motivation to be mindful of the body. If it's just some intellectual exercise just because of interest, you soon lose interest. But if it's something really important, you have a cancer, you have a arthritis, you have a difficulty, some disease in your body, you have like a strain in the body, it gets really important. You really are motivated. If you've got a cancer, you'll become very mindful of the body. It's life and death for you. It's more important than anything else. So, this means you really start becoming aware of your body. The first Satipatthana, you get to know it, feel it. And also, you notice how it changes, how it comes and goes. And especially what makes it, what's the causes. When it says in the Satipatthana, rise and fall, it doesn't mean just notice it so the feeling get more intense or less intense. It's also understanding why, the causes of these things. And that is, for anyone who doubts this, people often with Satipatthana, they just look at those two suttas. There's a whole Samyutta on Satipatthana. And this particular part of Satipatthana, which many people say just watch rise and fall, it does not mean that. Have a look at it. I might know this sutta because it's number 42 of the Satipatthana Samyutta. I know that because 42 is the answer to the meaning of life in Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. So it's really important. It's also how many years I've been a monk as well. So 42 years as a monk, which means that this is the time I get the answer to the meaning of the galaxy. 42. Special age. Anyway, it is, that shows it's what it really means is find out the causes of these things. Because once you find out the cause of the body and, you know, why it's sort of it's like this, why it's like this, and the experiences of the body, the pain, and the relaxation, once you know those causes, it's so easy to create the calm in the body, which is like the health, the relaxation. You're actually learning from the Satipatthana what causes the body to tense up, what causes it to relax. And that's what I've been teaching you. Hopefully you've been mindful enough of the body to know that. So it creates this wonderful vehicle, this body, so you can go to the next stages in meditation, which is this great deep stillness. But also, you've got now that was actually conflating the first two Satipatthanas on the body and experience. Noticing its causes, why it's like this, and why, you know, these feelings start to disappear. And it's also with the third satipatthana, the citta, the mind. So once you start with the body and its feelings, then you go into the mind with its feelings. You start exactly the same as you do with the body. Your mind, the peaceometer, the stressometer, that is Ajahn Brahm's take. Not only partially take, because there's many other parts of chit and upasana. Being aware of the mind. At least you can know that much. How peaceful are you? How stressed are you? You can do that. Now once you have that as your focus of mindfulness, that, you know, is part of the third of the satipatthana, the mind, then you find out what is the cause of more stress. What is the cause of more peace? You get that incredible wisdom. And it's just knowing that much, if you spend a lot of time just on the stressometer, peaceometer, you will find that it's so easy to create more peace in your life. You know, the causes of stress, instead of just being a victim, it's other people, it's having to do lots of stuff, you know, it's having a sick old body, that's the reason, it's having, you know, kids running around all day, that is not the cause of stress. Other stuff is. It's how you react to it. And I mentioned that again in one of those examples from the TED Talk, TED Channel, about the woman who did great research why people in stressful jobs have cardiac disease and why they don't. Nothing to do with the amount of stress in their life. Nothing to do with, you know, their DNA. Everything to do with their attitude to their job, to their stress. Once you see that, you understand, same with your mind. Peaceometer, stressometer, what puts that needle up with the stressometer, what puts it down in the peaceometer, attitude. Let go. Be kind. Open the door of your heart. If it's a monster in the Emperor's palace, welcome. Thank you for being in here. All those little stories. There's only two bad bricks in the wall. Look at the 998 good bricks. Hug a teddy bear. You find hugging a teddy bear, if you practice the satipatthana, you will notice your body relaxes and your peaceometer increases. So actually, hugging a teddy bear is satipatthana practice. So if people say, what did you do here? I did satipatthana. Oh, Ajahn Brahm taught satipatthana. Yes, with a teddy bear. And that is why. How many times have you gone to a Vipassana retreat and actually they called it bear awareness? That's where it comes from. It is bear awareness, by both meanings of the word. And it means you actually calm down. And also, it means that as you calm down and become more peaceful, because this is the thing you're watching in your mind, you're realizing the hindrances are decreasing. When you're calm and peaceful, restlessness goes, sloth and torpor goes, and because you are peaceful and happy, you don't have any craving anymore, no sensory desire. Who wants sensory desire? Well, you're already happy, no ill will, you're having a good time. When you're happy, it's just so difficult to get upset. Anyone who wins the lottery, no one can upset them. Someone calls them a pig and you laugh. I just won the lottery. I'm rich. You can call me whatever you like. You can crash into my car. It doesn't matter. You can actually mess up my blue suede shoes, as Elvis Presley. Even that, I don't mind. Because when you're really happy, so nothing can destroy it. You don't have ill will. You don't have desires when you're happy. You've already got happiness. What more do you want? So sometimes you experience that here. You're just sitting there in front of the kitchen with a cup of tea, just, you know, watching the beautiful scenery. You're just like, I came out a bit early for this talk, just sitting on the stupa. It's beautiful out there, just watching the trees. I've done that hundreds of times, but it's still beautiful. And just sitting there, just a nice wind coming up, until someone decided to take a photo of me. That's terrible, baby. I just enjoy myself, and next thing, click. That's okay, I don't mind. But it's beautiful, it's just so happy, so peaceful. When you're happy and peaceful like that, nothing can upset you. You don't need anything. You're just content, happy, easy, satisfied, not demanding anything. So you can see that when you start getting that peace, you should have enough mindfulness, the four satipatthana, to know there's no hindrances there. Not there anymore. Which means that in its place you have this beautiful enlightenment factors. The first is mindfulness. You don't investigate the Dhamma, the just Dhamma comes to teach you. You don't do anything. Just sitting there, just watching the trees. I didn't ask the trees for any questions. The trees show me their answers. That's what it's like. It's totally passive. And then we get things like pity and prasadi. This is the enlightenment factors. Pity. This is joy. And I haven't really said enough about joy yet, probably next few talks. The joy just grows. That's part of satipatthana. The more mindfulness you are, the more mindfulness you have, the more happiness. They go together. So when people come along and say, yes, I am very mindful, and I look at them, and I look especially at their mouth, that is, for me, is a mindfulness meter. If the edges are turned down, sorry mate, you're not mindful. Even if it's horizontal, nope, not good enough. Turned up at the edges, that's more like it. The more mindful you are, the happier you are, the more joyful you are. Because this is what happens, you know, the food tastes better the more mindful you are. I did tell this story in the last retreat, but here it comes again, one of my experiences. Years staying in this monastery, about 7 or 8 years in this monastery, and I came back from an appointment in the morning, had plenty of time, a beautiful spring morning before the flies came, and I told my driver, let me off at the bottom of Kingsby Drive, I'm going to walk up the hill. And it's very difficult for me to walk. Even here, people ask me, I don't mind, we don't need to walk to the monastery, I can give you a lift. Say, no, but no, I need to make good karma. Can I give you a lift? But I need to lose weight, okay? And honestly, a senior monk, it's very difficult to get exercise. You start walking and someone stops to give you a lift. So anyway, there I was. I argued, cajoled, got out of the car. And when I got out of the car, you know, walking up the hill, it's about 2.5 kilometers. And as I was walking, just really relaxed, plenty of time, no rush, I looked at that hillside and I could not recognize it. It looked totally different than anything I'd ever seen before. I've been living up here 7 or 8 years at the time, it's been almost 32 years now. 7 or 8 years and I couldn't recognize my surroundings. I must have gone up and down the hills 3 or 4 times a week. And oh, it really shocked me. What's going on here? Have I got the right hillside? And I saw things I'd never seen before. So I stopped walking and stared in disbelief. And as I stopped, the hillside actually changed again. I started to see things I'd never, ever, ever seen in 7 or 8 years. You know, little rocks, little wildflowers. See all the blades of grass. See, in the valley, the little stream bubbling over the rocks. You know, it's literally twinkling in the sunshine. It was absolutely gorgeous. And even the grass, I've never ever seen it that green before. And it was just so beautiful. And I thought, someone's put something in my tea this morning. I'm going crazy. And, you know, it really shook me. And I had to continue on the walk up the hillside, but I started contemplating, what on earth has happened? Number one, how come I haven't recognized that before? And how come I've seen so much more? And what I saw had never been so beautiful ever before. And then I realized, this is a great simile for mindfulness. When you are looking through the window of a speeding car, you think you can see what's on the other side, but you don't. Flashing images, that's all you see. And just like in the old days when I used to develop my own photographs before digital cameras, You put the photographic paper in the chemical solution and slowly it appears on the paper. That's actually similar, the chemical reaction in the back of your eye. What's actually happening here? The chemical reaction doesn't have time to properly form, to complete, before another image comes up, and then another image, and then another image. That's what it's like, looking through the window of a car. I got out and walked. My eye had more time to form a proper image. So I saw more detail, and the colour was richer. But even walking was not good enough. I stood perfectly still and stared. Only then did the image have all the time it needed to completely form. And when it did, I saw so much detail, and all the colours were rich like you'd never seen before. Those colours were always there, but I never gave them time to fully manifest, except when I was still. And I realized this is what mindfulness and joy are all about. We all go way too fast, even on this retreat, let alone outside. Outside, you think you know even the road in which you live. I challenge you, if you always got up and down that road in your car, try just walking to the end of the road and back, slowly. You'll notice so much more you've never seen before. Stop every now and again and stare. And who knows, if you're still enough, everything becomes just so beautiful. This is what happens with mindfulness getting strong. On this retreat, mindfulness is already improving, and then it gets really strong. And everything, you see so much detail, and it looks so beautiful. At last, the colours are fully there. Yellows, browns like you've never seen before. Food like you've never tasted before. It's absolutely delicious. Those flavours have always been there, but you've been just too dull to notice them. Strong mindfulness and joy always go together. People can convince themselves, fool themselves they're mindful, but joy, you can't fool that. So when you're joyful, great. This is what's supposed to happen. When the food tastes really delicious, when the trees are just so incredible, the scenery is just amazing, the sky and the clouds are just wow. Now you're being mindful. It's part of the path, the joy, it's part of the enlightenment factors. Joy, tranquility, just the stillness, and eventually the equanimity. Just be so at ease with everything. Those are enlightenment factors. So that is actually what the Satipatthana is all about. You know, you're mindful of the body, so it can relax and don't cause you any pain and trouble anymore. And you can do that even with sicknesses, as I've mentioned, with colds and what's the other one? Arthritis and food poisoning and all this other stuff which sometimes you get. You just relax it. And you're being mindful of the body and understanding the peaceometer or the stressometer of your mind. And it's so important, because then you are really relaxing, you're becoming peaceful. You recognize what I'm talking about, become familiar with it and ease with it, and it just becomes almost like second nature. You know how to do that. And lastly, to make sure hindrances, they're not there. Instead, these enlightenment factors instead. Satipatthana. And it becomes a huge, powerful support for the stillness which comes next. So that is Satipatthana. Also, how to overcome some of the more refined obstacles to meditation. Sadhu. 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 Very good. Okay, I've got a full program of interviews this morning, every slot taken, so please be prompt and have to be on time, because I've got to go to monastery. And have a wonderful morning. You don't have to. If you want to have a miserable morning, you have my full permission.